Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. And on the line here with us, joining us as a third-time guest, not once, not twice, but the third time that he's joined us here on this podcast. He is an author. He is a mortgage lender. He specializes in physicians, dentists, CRNAs, and PAs. And, of course, you'll hear him on his own podcast, the Physician Financial Success Podcast. I am talking about no other than Josh Metal. Welcome, Josh.
Dave, I'm glad to be here, and you have me hoping that the third time is the charm, and this is going to be the best podcast we do together yet.
That's it. This will be the best. I don't know. The other two are pretty hard to beat, the pregnant wife rule and, you know, all of those things we talked about in the last podcast.
Well, I'm excited to be here, and we're going to do our best to make this the best ever.
All right, my friend. Well, since the last time we spoke, it's kind of interesting. I would definitely recommend to people to check out the prior two podcasts. The first one was actually a YouTube video we had done. I converted to a podcast. The second one we did was a video we talked about rental real estate. So one focused on buying homes, the other on rental real estate. And since it's been, I think, 2 years since the last podcast, I figured it was a great time to check back in. We haven't talked a lot about real estate or mortgages. This is the time of the year. This podcast is going to be coming out in March when residents are thinking about transitioning to practice and buying their first home. Or maybe you've just been an attending that's been at it for a year or two and you're thinking about buying your first home, or maybe you're changing a job. And so what a great time to talk about homes and rentals and buying their first place. Now, Josh, I have to say it's kind of interesting. I'm looking at a graph here of interest rates, and it's been a bit of a V situation the last 5 years. You know, about back beginning of 2014, around the time that you and I had connected first, you know, we had interest rates, if you look at some like 10-year treasuries, they're at 3%. They went all the way down to like 1.25% almost in the middle of 2016. And now we're just right back to where we were, right? We've made a V shape in terms of interest rates, where we're pushing back on 3% on a 10-year treasury. What's your take, you know, overall on interest rates and things of that nature?
Well, I think there are two powerful colliding forces that are new to the market in the last 90 days, or at least that we haven't seen in probably at least a decade. And I think that both of these are pretty strong indicators that interest rates are going to go higher from here. And when I talk about interest rates, I'm specifically talking about mortgage interest rates. Those two forces are, number one, the Federal Reserve is decided to unwind or allow their quantitative easing program to end. And so what that means, and a lot of people have kind of forgotten or don't really understand what QE was all about, but essentially in 2010, after the crash, the Federal Reserve said, what mechanism do we have to control long-term interest rates? And there was not one in place. The Federal Reserve sets the Fed funds rate, which is the short-term interest rate market, and a lot of other interest rates kind of benchmark off of the Fed funds rate, but they really didn't have a mechanism to effectively influence long-term interest rates. We're talking 10, 30-year rates. And so what they decided to do was to start this quantitative easing program where they would effectively become the market or a large chunk of the market to buy treasury bills and mortgage-backed securities, which would effectively push down long-term interest rates. You can think about it as soon as rates started to trend upwards, they would come in and buy the market and buy those interest rates in such quantity that it pushed interest rates down. Well, fast forward to 2017, 2018, The Federal Reserve now owns $4.5 trillion. Most people, you know, can't really think exponentially with that many zeros, but it is a massive, massive number. And they own $4.5 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bills. And just in November of 2017, they had announced that they're no longer reinvesting the proceeds from those treasury bills. When you own that quantity of treasury bills and mortgage-backed securities, there's interest that comes off. And when a bond matures, then they could reinvest that principal. And they were, in effect, just keeping this leveling off of the long-term interest rate market. As of November,
Just for a second. I just want to sit on that just for a moment. So if we think about this, everyone, $4.5 trillion of debt, right, that they own, essentially. They own this debt. If we multiply that, let's just use a really small number of 3%. That's $135 billion a year just in interest. Now, in this program, I believe, and Josh, correct me if I have this incorrectly, that not only were they reinvesting interest, they were reinvesting principal as principal came in as well. So not only $135 billion in interest a year, but principal and reinvesting new notes too, right?
That's exactly right. So if they had invested in a 2-year treasury bill or a 10-year treasury bill and that bond had matured, then you get your principal back. So not only were they reinvesting the interest payments, but they were also reinvesting or rolling forward the principal into buying new bonds. You're exactly right.
So huge balance sheet, and now they're saying, okay, we're going to start to unwind this. And they're not necessarily doing it all tomorrow, right? I mean, this is a process over time. At least that's what they've said at this particular point.
That's right. But what you're starting to see is the moment that started to come to fruition, where they said, okay, we're no longer buying, and not only are we not only buying new bonds, but we're not reinvesting either. We're going to what they call let the balance sheet roll off. As soon as that happened, the bond market said, well, wait a minute, why would we want to buy new bonds today if we know that down the road we're probably going to be able to buy bonds at a higher yield? So you've started to see rates start to move up because the bond market, the real bond market, other than the fake bond market, which is what the Fed was doing through QE, is now saying, you know, let's wait for rates to move up and then we'll start buying bonds again as rates move up. And so you're starting to see bonds start to move higher or yields start to move higher, which means the rates that people are going to pay on mortgages are starting to move higher.
Right. And that's the whole context for our conversation is how does this impact buying homes and those kinds of things. And you have a great report that you had sent my way, which we are making available on drfreedompodcast.com/homevalues, which has a link to Josh's blog that talks about this report that we're going to dig into here. So again, drfreedompodcast.com/homevalues. And in that particular report, what you talk about is this difference between supply and demand in the housing market. And you have some great graphs and data and, on this particular report. And it's interesting, you know, I talk to so many different physicians all across the country, and I feel this pressure that people look at rates rising. And they say, oh, gosh, I have to get a home. Maybe they're sick of paying rent, right? But there's also that tension of they haven't saved a lot. They don't have 5% down. They don't have 10% down to buy a house. When you look at states like California, right, someone in San Francisco, you know, it's $2 million to buy a shack out there in San Francisco. So can you talk about some of that tension, that pressure that residents and fellows and new attending physicians might have on them?
Absolutely. I want to just take one step back, if I could, Dave, because I said there were two forces that were pushing rates higher, in my estimation. And I just quickly want to go back and touch on the second force. We talked about force number one is QE unwinding the balance sheet and taking away the artificial market with keeping rates low. But the second force is inflation. And we've had deflation to slow inflation since the crash. And if you look at the most recent consumer price index, which is the is an index that tracks the cost of goods and services, it also tracks wages that are being paid to employees. And what you're noticing is there is a steepening of inflation. It is starting to move up much more quickly. In fact, quicker than was anticipated by a lot of the experts from the last reading. And the reason that's important, Dave, is because if I am a bond investor, and this isn't financial advice, I'm just trying to teach the mechanism that would push rates higher. If I own a bond and I say, Dave, I'm going to give you $100,000, and in return, I want a 4% interest rate, it's my anticipation as an investor that I can go out tomorrow or next week or next year, and I can buy a certain amount of goods and services with that $4,000. Now, as a bond investor, if I'm seeing that inflation is ticking up, that means that in 2019, 2020, maybe that $4,000 only buys me $3,000 worth of bonds and services or goods and services. So if cost of stuff and services is going up, as a bond investor, I'm going to say, I'm not cool with that 4% rate of return anymore because I know next year it's only going to get me $3,000 worth of stuff. So now I want a 5% rate of return because that is going to pay me $5,000, which is going to equal the same amount of stuff that I could buy with the 4%. So as inflation goes up, bond investors will require a higher rate of interest, which means that's another force that's going to push mortgage rates higher. So I just wanted to close that loop.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's a great point and one that a lot of people sense out there. And so getting back to kind of the report, you have 3 year-end stats that, in your opinion, tell you a lot about demand and future supply. You talk about new home sales, existing homes, permits. Can you talk a little bit about those, Josh, in terms of what you're seeing in terms of how that might be affecting demand and supply?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at that report, the first graph that I showed was an illustration of U.S. new home sales. So these are home builders building new construction homes. And the graph goes back to the early 1960s. And as you go from left to right, from the 1960s to today, what you'll see is on average, the U.S. was producing homes, new homes, somewhere in the 600,000 new homes per year range. Now, around 1995, you started to see an uptick, and we went all the way up to producing 1.4 million new homes. And then the crash happened. And a lot of that, you know, if you look at the graph, it gets real steep. And a lot of that was because there was really fake demand going on because you had the liar loans, right? No income, no asset, no job, no problem. People, bartenders were buying 10 houses, and that really caused a big spike in new home construction. Then there was this massive crash, and we went from 1.4 million down to about 300,000 new homes being built. And if you fast forward from 2010-ish to 2018, we're still only producing about 700,000 new homes. So we're half of the new home supply that we were before the crash. And we've seen 10 years of population growth, 10 years of economic expansion. So the amount of supply of new homes coming to the market is not enough. I mean, we're only tied back to the amount of homes we were building back in the early 1970s. We're just not building enough new homes to keep up with demand.
Well, I think that's definitely pushing up prices. I mean, you look at, I was talking to a friend in San Francisco the other day, which of course that place is more inflated than practically anywhere else. And the affordability is a problem once again. You know, if you look at that, I mean, you have to be making, you know, a mil to 2 mil a year to make it easy in a budget if you want to own just your own home by yourself. And what he was telling me was, you know, people would buy a home and you have 4 or 5 families that will pile into a place because
right.
no one can afford it. So, I mean, to me, I see you're totally right, you know, about the supply issue. But on the other hand, we have an affordability problem, at least in many areas of the country. Here in the Midwest, I'm in Minnesota, you're in Utah. You know, affordability probably isn't so much of an issue, I would guess, in Utah. But on the coast, it's back to nutso land. You know, how do we marry those two together, you know, in terms of being able to afford a home versus the supply issue?
Well, you nailed the right term, and that is affordability. And I think you just need to apply common sense. If the herd is buying $2 million homes that it takes 4 families to debt service comfortably, it's time to rent. I mean, unless you are really in a financial situation where you've got more money than you know what to do with, or you can put a massive down payment. It's time to rent. That just seems to be the common sense, logical decision, although the herd might be headed in the other direction. It's time to break from the herd and be a contrarian there. Now, on the other hand, if we circle back to affordability, where you're at, where I'm at in Utah, you can still buy a very nice home for $400,000 or $500,000, and you can buy a luxury home for $700,000 or $800,000. And if you look at those payments, you know, on a we just ran an analysis on a $350,000 home with a 5% down payment for a physician, all in taxes, insurance, the whole deal. They were at about $2,000 a month, very affordable. You know, most residents or fellows can afford that, or newly out of training and want to keep your payments akin to what they were in residency, so you can pay off your student loans. You can still do that. But I think you just need to apply common sense. And if you're on those coastal areas, it's okay to just take a break from owning a home and to rent and to pay off every debt under the sun, moon, and stars, and make sure you start investing heavily for retirement.
I think that's a great point, and one I fully agree with. I mean, even if your rent does cost you a whole lot of money, $4,000, $5,000 a month, which sounds insane, but if you think about the kind of house you could buy with $4,000, $5,000 a month, what do you think, Josh? That's probably $800,000, something like that, $900,000?
You're probably around $1 million, $1.1 million, just depending on where you are and what property taxes are, but yeah, I bet you're north of $1 million.
North of $1 million. So whereas you would have to, if you had buy, you know, you might be at $2 million for some of those properties that I've heard about from some of my contacts and friends. So just keep that in mind, my friends. You know, you want to do that calculation of what it would take to buy, you know, that $4,000, $5,000 a month versus actually owning the thing. Josh, any other thoughts?
Dave,
you know, in terms. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go. Yeah, I was going where you were going. I'm sorry I interrupted. I think that common sense is underappreciated here, and the direction of the herd can kind of take over. But if you look at your budget and you say, hey, you know, we make $8,000 a month. Is a $3,000 or $2,000 a month house affordable for us? Are we going to be able to maintain a lifestyle, still invest, still stay on top of our paying down our liabilities? Yes. Then that makes sense. If you're making a decision where you say, okay, I can pull off this house, but that means I'm doing minimal contributions to my retirement accounts, I'm probably not funding my children's college education, I'm definitely not planning for their future weddings, I'm not going on vacations, I'm not, you know, there's a high likelihood I'm cutting this thing so close, if anything happens, I'm going to have to live off some credit cards. The common sense tells you that's just not the right call. You know what I mean? So just get out the calculator, run those payments, look at your checkbook every month, and if you can do it affordably, I think homeownership is the right way to go. If common sense says that's where every nickel's going to go to and it's going to be uncomfortable, then, you know, apply common sense and don't do it.
And you guys hear me talk about this time and time again. Where you live matters, right?
Definitely.
That when you live in beautiful, wonderful places, I'm from California originally, but when you live there, not only are you paying more, you're often getting paid less. So, you know, if you are a resident, if you're a fellow, you're listening to this, really think about as you transition to practice about where you live can impact you. You know, if you go and spend a few years in Alaska to pay off your student debts and you're getting paid twice as much as you would in California, that might be a better move for you.
Well, let's take a moment for a quick commercial break. Well, my friends, if you are sitting here confused by all these tax changes, wondering how the heck does this impact me? I mentioned in January, the beginning of this year, that I am going to make available to you my calculator showing all the different scenarios laid out on how this whole thing works. So for this month and the next one, if you text all one word, less taxes, LESSTAXES, all one word, less taxes, to 44222, you can grab that calculator right now. Go ahead and text less taxes, all one word, LESSTAXES, to 44222. And if you're interested in wanting to get the tax reduction prescription, the newest version of it, definitely text there as well, because that will give you early access to the next version of the tax reduction prescription. Again, text less taxes, all one word, LESSTAXES, to 44222. And now, back to the show.
Josh, any thoughts on your end, just in terms of what you see residents and fellows and those prospering financially that you're seeing as they transition to practice and what that looks like?
Well, I think the best advice out there is to try to live in terms of expenses similarly to how you did when you were a resident, and then you take that bump up in income and you use that to pay off the student loans. Or as you said, you take some maybe less than ideal position for just a couple of years, and maybe not. Maybe Alaska is a dream. There's a lot of cool stuff in Alaska. I was just there last year. I absolutely loved it. But maybe you take a sacrifice that isn't yours or your spouse's first choice, but you say, look, 2 years and we can get ourselves completely above water. And then we can make, you know, maybe the next place is Hawaii. And it doesn't have to be a financial decision. It's just a lifestyle decision. So keep expenses low for the first couple years out of training. And then the other thing that crossed my mind was, you know, here in Utah, and there's places like this all over the country, but here in Utah, for $600,000 or $800,000, you can enjoy a very, very nice home. Cost of living is very low. You have 6 ski resorts within 45 minutes. You have fishing, mountain biking. I mean, just the most incredible type lifestyle is available to you. And incomes are for physicians are still relatively strong. So where you live does matter. And I think it's important for people to really think that through if they want to reside in a really high expense area.
Absolutely. Thank you. So one of the things that I want to bring back to that I've been mulling over personally, I've talked with people that I work with about, is the impact of rising rates on home prices. Now, there's not necessarily a exact correlation. Every market is different, right? You know, Minnesota, Utah, the coast, you know, all of those can differ depending upon the market. But in general, just as a generalization, my thought is there comes to be a point, which maybe that's not today, but as rates rise, mortgage rates rise, that there is a point that there is an impact on housing prices. Agree, disagree? What do you think?
I think it goes back to your previous point, which is affordability. So let's take a couple of different real life scenarios. If you are the buyer in San Francisco who is stretching, and that's kind of the community consensus. Everybody just stretches every penny into housing because, you know, real estate prices only ever go up, right? And you have to be a homeowner. And then we start to see interest rates go from 3.5% on a 10-1 ARM to 5%, 6%.
Right.
If rates move that quickly and you're stretched that thin, there's a very good chance that affordability is going to fall off the edge of the cliff and prices are going to have to come down. Now, in a Goldilocks scenario, here's what would happen. And I think this very much is dependent on where you live, which is another great point. There's a lot of factors that affect affordability. So let's just talk about a couple. One of them is interest rates. The other one, home prices. The other one, however, is wages. So, you know, what part of the CPI consumer price index reading that shot that inflation up is that real wages are starting to increase at a much faster pace than it has for the last 10 years. So if wages are going up, and that is a buffer or neutralizes the effect on affordability that an increasing interest rate. Another force that just to keep in consideration is most Americans got somewhat of a tax break this year. And they're going to have more deductions. If you're private practice, there's going to be some additional benefits for you there. So there may also be an offsetting force from additional cash in your pocket because most Americans are going to pay a little less taxes. But I think it goes back to if you're stretched to the hilt and you're in one of those coastal areas and rates go up, absolutely, I do think that could have an impact on those home prices. It's going to be hard to take all of the moving pieces into consideration and exactly forecast where this goes in the next year or two.
Well, I believe one of the impacts on the mortgage industry, if I remember correctly, is that when your home is and you buy new, you're buying a home, never had bought a home before. Is it over $1 million mortgage that the interest stops becoming mortgage tax deductible?
I believe it's $750,000 for married couples now.
$750K. So there is a limit on when you get that deductibility. And I just want to review over just to have everyone think about this. You know, if we have a 1% interest rate increase for a mortgage and someone has $1 million mortgage, right, that's $10,000 more a year if they have an adjustable rate. You know, if you're talking at 2%, that's $20,000 a year on $1 million mortgage. But if only you have a $300,000 mortgage, as Josh was saying, you know, 1% is $3,000 a year, which with some of the tax package stuff, that could not be a bad thing. Or 2% is $6,000. You know, that's not going to kill most people's budget. It might sting a little bit, but it's not going to kill it. Any thoughts on that, Josh?
Yeah, I think the takeaway is it is very likely, high probability that interest rates are going up, and that is a potential risk to markets that we haven't seen, and we don't know exactly how that's going to play out because there's a lot of economic expansion that's still happening, and wage inflation or wage growth might keep pace with that, but it is a risk that is out there in the market, and it is probably a good indicator that this is not the time to stretch and really overspend in any real estate market.
Absolutely. But nonetheless, I think the point of your article being that with having only so much inventory that over the long term, right, that more than likely home prices will rise, right? You know, it's there's going to be little deflationary forces from time to time, but overall with population growth and with the supply issues that there hasn't been much put on the market, I mean that in the long term, we should expect home prices to be much higher than they are today.
Yeah, let's say we chop off the expensive coast and we talk to, you know, the other 45 states or whatever it is, 42 states. And if you take out those really high price areas, if you talk to the rest of the country, what we're seeing nationally is an exceedingly low inventory of homes for sale. So you have, as of December of 2017, National Association of Realtors said there's only 3.4 months worth of inventory. When we were going into the bubble, there was like 18-month inventories in many markets across the country. And if you have less than 6-month inventory of home for sales in any market, it's considered a seller's market. So we're near record lows in terms of inventory. So that's supply. That's the supply side of the equation. On the demand side of the equation, you have an increase in wages that's starting to happen nationally. You've got an expanding economy. You have these new tax breaks for corporations. You know, right after the announcement of the tax laws went into effect, Apple said they were going to bring something like $60 billion from overseas. They were going to repatriate that capital back to the United States. They were going to pay something like $18 billion in taxes on that money. And then they had announced another $35 or $36 billion in domestic spending and investment for that money, factories, research facilities. So there is a lot going for us in 2018 that is looking like a continued expansion in the economy. So if you've got healthy economy and rising wages and a near record low inventory of housing, I believe that is going to, you know, very simple supply and demand is going to point to higher home prices in 2018.
And as you look at that, you are someone that owns a lot of rental real estate. With you and your family, something that you guys have been doing for a long time. Let's now segue into talking about rentals. For those of us that are practicing physicians that are listening to this podcast, you're like, I already own a home. I've owned a home for a long time. Let's speak to some of our friends here who own rentals or are thinking about owning rentals, are interested in owning rentals. How are you thinking about that aspect, knowing with some of the, particularly more in the middle of the country rather than the coast, which would be more attractive for rentals anyhow. How are you thinking about that, Josh, just for you personally? You know, do you want to acquire? Do you want to just kind of hold on to what you have? You know, how are you thinking about renting and rentals with you and your situation?
Yeah, and maybe just a little context. So I'm a fourth generation landlord and apartment owner. My mother and my wife and I currently co-own, manage, and operate about 125 doors in all in Salt Lake City, Utah. And you know, I look at those properties like they're my kids. In other words, I never personally think of selling them because if you look at real estate appreciation rates in Utah, at least going back over the last 30, 40 years, the annual appreciation rate is about 4%. So if you apply the rule of 72, which says you divide 72 by the rate of appreciation, and that'll tell you how many years it takes you for an asset price to double. So if I look at the asset price of those 125 units, and I say, okay, I'm 40 this year, at 58, those units are going to double, and they'll almost all be paid off because I started investing when I was 20, I bought my first rental property. And then by the time I'm 76, they're going to double again. And you start to look at the massive, and when I say double, not only does the price of the asset double, and that I'm not really all that concerned about because, again, I fully intend to die and those will be Xander and Aria's assets, but the rental income has also risen at a similar pace over the long term. So the rental income, if I double that rental income a couple of times over my lifetime, it starts to be pretty fun to be in your 70s and 80s because you can do a lot of fun stuff with that kind of rental income each month. And so for me, the way I look at that is really a freeing perspective. I don't look at my assets in retirement as finite, and when I get to a certain place, I'll stop working, and then I'll then live off the principal and interest of my assets and hope to not burn through my assets before I die. By the time I go into retirement, there will be such abundance of cash flow from those rental properties, and I'm not even calculating the additional rental properties I'll continue to buy. But it really makes it fun to dream with my spouse and to dream with my kids. You know, what do we want to do in our 70s? You know, do we want to live in France? Do we want to live in Europe? Do we want to spend a year in every country that we ever wanted to visit? And that just makes me happy. And it really helps me psychologically get fired up to come to work and work in my day-to-day profession when I know that it's a really, really fun place for me from an investment standpoint down the road. So it gives me a lot of security and comfort. And in terms of what we're doing right now, we're cautiously buying. So we are aware that there are investors out there paying for apartment buildings, just insane multiples and cap rates that don't make any sense to me whatsoever. And we're going to let them have that segment of the market that they're going after. But there is a smaller segment of the market that that we'll call them the big boys, the big investors don't play in. And these are the single family homes up through maybe 30 units. And this segment of the market is not so much invested in by hedge funds and other wealth funds. And we can go in and we can buy a property that needs some maintenance. We can do some capital improvements. We can make it look swanky and modern and hip and bling, as my mom would say. She likes to bling the apartment units. And we can increase rents, and we can still have a very nice return on investment and cash flow. So we're cautiously buying, knowing that there's some segments of the market that are just out of whack, and we don't want to play in that.
Interesting. No, that's a great perspective. So it's the kind of, well, there's single family homes, duplexes, triplexes, smaller amounts of doors. Do you have, I know the passive income MD, you know, he sets a goal of trying to buy one a year, one new building a year. Do you have a goal like that for yourself? Or is it just kind of like, you know, as the opportunity presents itself, you know, are you actively sending letters out? You know, what does that look like for you in terms of how you go about acquiring properties and some of your goals related to real estate?
We're back to having goals now, but I will tell you that, you know, we owned 100 doors when we went into the crash of 2008 through 10, and Utah really didn't hit till 2010. And it was, you know, hold on to your seats. Let's see if we can ride the storm through probably 2005. And we didn't buy anything, but we also didn't lose anything. We kept every single property. We didn't sell undervalued. We didn't let anything go back to the bank. We just rode that out. And then it, since 2015, we have been slowly buying, and it's our goal to take on one major project a year. So 2 years ago, it was a sevenplex. Then it was a duplex that we bought the next year. And the duplex was a major remodel. I mean, it was like $75,000 remodel per side. So it was a big remodel. High-end, you know, nice high-end area. Just the home hadn't been renovated for 35 years, needed a total reconstruct. This year, we bought a 22-unit apartment building that we partnered with a local construction company, smaller construction company, and called Breen Homes. And we're going to go in and we're going to completely solidify the framework of the entire apartment building and the infrastructure. We're doing, you know, everything brand new. It'll be a major project. And we think that'll take us all of 2018. And then we have a goal to do another project in 19. So not so many how many doors. We're just looking for the right opportunity. And we want to make sure that we do at least one project a year.
That's a good goal. I mean, think about that, right? I mean, if you get, let's just use a small number, $1,000 cash flow a month from buying one property, right? That's your net to you, $1,000 a month from doing something like this. And you do that once every 3 years. Let's not even do it every year, right? Once every 3 years. I mean, you do that 10 times over 30 years, you got $10,000 a month of income, which some of that would have probably gone up in terms of rents. I mean, that's huge. If you just do that once every 3 years, to do it once a year could be tremendous. Any thoughts on that in terms of, you know, how do you think about a number? You know, when is enough enough, right? Or is it just the game that you enjoy?
That's a good question. I very seldomly think of the number. I more frequently think about, this is something that I do with my mother and my wife, and it gives us a lot of connection, and it is a fun business that we enjoy running. And now we've started to partner with a local real estate group. We've partnered with a local construction group, and we can meld our unique abilities together, where we're good at management and accounting and rent collection and evictions and legal entity structuring, and they're good at finding deals and renovating and constructing the properties. So for us, it's just a fun game that brings abundance and future abundance to everybody we play with, and it's just a lot of fun, to be honest.
Absolutely. No, I totally hear that, especially I relate to that with some of the land stuff that I'm doing that you and I briefly talked about before the call got going. Well, Josh, I want to wrap up the call for today, and I would recommend everyone to check out Josh's podcast, Physician Financial Success. Check out his book, Why Physician Home Loans Fail. Josh, best way to get a hold of you, any final thoughts for the podcast today?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly you could email me at josh@joshmetal.com. You can Google me and, connect with me through Facebook or LinkedIn as well. And final thoughts. It is an interesting world that we live in, and I'm grateful for people like you that are doing their best to bring financial literacy and at least thinking about people's financial future, so they don't end up somewhere they didn't intend to end up. So I just want to compliment you in closing and tell you thanks so much for having me, and I respect what you do very much.
Well, thank you, Josh. Really appreciate you coming on the third time. Must have not offended you too badly the first two. So glad to have you back. You're a great guest, so thank you for checking us out. And everyone, you can check out Josh at joshmettle.com, joshmettle.com. Right, Josh?
That'll work. Yes. Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
All right, my friends. Well, that wraps it up for today in the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Make sure to check out the podcast website at drfreedompodcast.com, or check out that special report that Josh wrote at drfreedompodcast.com/homevalues. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.
Well, there was the show. Hope you loved it. And of course, we want to make sure to remember that right now is the time. If you are confused about this tax stuff, you want the latest copy of the tax reduction prescription and that calculator I was talking about in January, there's no better time to grab that than right now. Text less taxes, LESSTAXES, to 44222. Again, that's all one word, less taxes, LESSTAXES. Thank you again so much for listening. Blessings to you. Have a good one.